Welcome to the Knowledgeable Parent Podcast, where we share tips, research, and resources to help you to make the best decisions for yourself, your children, and your family as you learn to live your best life as a parent. I'm your host, a South Dakota licensed marriage and family therapist, a registered play therapist supervisor, and most importantly, a mom, Emily Laring. Hello and welcome to today's podcast. I am so excited for today's episode. Today I have Shanna Mokey and Erin Nielsen Ogdahl with me, and we're going to be discussing parent coordination and custody evaluations. Welcome, ladies.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So the reason that I am so excited to have you both on the show today is because there is a lot of confusion that exists in our community about custody and who has the power to do what when parents are in disagreement on their parenting decisions. So I'm really excited that we're going to be able to have this conversation to help out the parents in the Sioux Falls area and the surrounding areas to just get a better understanding of what each of these services are and where they can turn when these parenting disagreements arise. So I think to get started today, before we get into the weeds of what is parent coordination, what is a custody evaluation, it would be helpful for our listeners if you both share a little bit about yourself, about your career, and what led you to become a provider of these services. Erin, go ahead and start.
Sure. Well, my background is in social work. I have a bachelor's and a master's degree in social work, but I always, from an early age, wanted to be an attorney. So once I finished up my master's degree, I moved back to South Dakota and went to law school. I practiced for a couple years and realized I kind of that heart of a social worker did not work well in some of the attorney work I was doing. So I stumbled across someone who was doing custody evaluations where I was practicing law and did that training and have transitioned into a private practice where I combine these custody related services. I also do some individual therapy, family therapy with individuals with mental health and substance use issues. So kind of bringing it all together, the different backgrounds and experiences that I have.
Perfect. Thank you. And Shanna, what about you?
My background is in human development, is what my undergrad and my graduate degree are both in human development and family studies. When I did my master's program, I focused it in on custody and visitation work up in the cities. Fell into work at Family Court Services in Minneapolis, and I worked there for about 7 years where I got some really great training in all aspects of custody and visitation. Since 2010, I've been in private practice in Sioux Falls, and so my focus on work is in custody evaluations, mediation, parent coordination. I do co-parent education. We oversee the supervised visitation program and drug testing. I see myself kind of getting education in areas of mental health, substance abuse, legal areas, you know, kind of a in-between area because it is such a focused, specialized area of work that you kind of have to have a background in a lot of different aspects, and so I enjoy consultation and learning that.
Perfect. Yeah, it definitely sounds like you guys come from a variety of different areas of knowledge bases, so that's really awesome to hear. Okay, so let's get started with the topic of parent coordination first. Let's just talk about what is parent coordination or what is a parenting coordinator, and maybe if you guys can talk about too, like how it is different than some of the other services that might be available in the community.
I'm going to start.
Sure. Parent coordination is a court-ordered service. It has to be court-ordered. Parties can stipulate to that, but most parent coordinators will require it to be court-ordered because it is statutorily defined in South Dakota statutes, which we are lucky to have. A lot of states don't have it in their statutes. So it's very clearly defined in our statutes pretty thoroughly. And so the judge will appoint it, and it's supposed to have a very specific appointment order as far as the duties and the limitations of what they are. But the essence of a parent coordinator is to try and help parents resolve issues without having to go to court and to alleviate that burden on the judge when the judge is there for maybe more of the major issues. And so it may be some of the gray areas in the court order or things that come up that maybe need more of an emergent response, sort of like a caseworker to a point where you're helping this family through things. It's meant for families that are deemed to be a little more high conflict that require that kind of hands-on assistance. It's court-ordered. Like I said, it's a very specific role where a parent coordinator will facilitate agreements. And then if they cannot agree, then they can either make a recommendation or a decision, which is binding on the parties unless or until they go to court to overturn that.
Okay. So does a co-parenting team reach out to you whenever they have this conflict? If they do get set up with a parenting coordinator, is it something that you're checking in with them regularly, ask them how things are going, or they reach out to you when they've come to a disagreement?
I would say it depends on the case. I'm always very clear once I get an order for a new case that we all sit down and meet together, as long as there's no issues of domestic violence or that they can't be in a room together. I require us all to meet together to go through the agreement, to go through their court order, to set some goals for the process. And usually in the beginning, we'll tackle those goals, so we may meet more often or we may not have to. It really just depends on the case. But for most of my cases, at least, they do reach out when there's an area of conflict. Or, for instance, I'll say, let's set a meeting in March to set the summer schedule, or let's set a meeting in July to set the kids' activity schedule. It's really case dependent on what they need and where the problems lie. Some I hear from 10 times a day, some I don't hear from for 6 months. So sure. It really okay. just depends. And that's one of the challenges for me with parent coordination. And Shannon and I have talked about this a lot over the years, is you don't know how many cases to take because sometimes it can be so quiet. And yeah. then all of a sudden you get slammed and maybe it's a week you're already busy. So the management of it can be difficult because there isn't a lot of predictability.
Okay. And how does parent coordination end? Is that something that's ordered by the judge, that the families are able to work things out and they don't need a parent coordinator anymore?
Each of our contracts has a duration of appointment. Okay. Mine is 2 years. Some of them differ. Every 2 years, I may have them just renew the contract, or if they're done with services. One case I've had the entire 10 years I've been here. The judge could dismiss, or they could dismiss by stipulation if they agree, or I could quit if I don't see the need for it.
Okay.
I would agree, though, with the way that Erin does hers. I do it the same way. I initially meet with them, open a case, to get the background, have them put down a retainer is how they do it. And then if or when they need me, then they contact me. Okay. And so they may need me more often, maybe not. But if they go a period of a year or 18 months without contacting me, at that point, I usually do it around Christmas time, where I refund the retainer and say, I'm going to close on your case. You don't need me right now. Congrats. You know, no news is good news. Really, yeah. if they don't need us, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And so I close down the case, and then if they need to come back, we just renew the contract. As far as that appointment, I think always stands in the order that if they ever do need, they need to use a parent coordinator before going to court, so they may come back down the road.
Sure. Okay. So Erin, you alluded to like the schedule being something that people might disagree with. What are some other common disagreements that you guys hear about as parent coordinators?
Scheduling is huge. Kids' activities are a pretty large one, especially the older kids get, although our younger kids are more and more involved these days, so that can be challenging too. Holidays a lot. School decisions come up pretty regularly.
When you say like the school activities, the sporting events and things like that, is it whether or not to enroll them? Is it financial disagreements? Do they have differing opinions on what is best for the kid?
It really depends. And I'll tell people, my husband and I are married and live in the same house and have two kids and have, you know, pretty similar ideas of parenting, and we disagree on things. Mm-hmm. So when you've gone through a divorce and probably don't like this person and have very different ideas, there's going to be a lot of things that come up. So it can be everything that you mentioned. It, again, just really depends. Some people have a similar direction. Some people are planning on their child playing college sports where the other one would rather they be in music. You know, sure. It can be as far apart as possible, or it can be pretty similar. What team are we going to sign up for? So there's really no predictability when it comes to parent coordination in my world.
Sure.
I'd say extracurriculars are one area that seems to be overlooked in court orders sometimes.
Okay.
And so as far as who registers, that they have to notify each other, that they should talk with each other prior to registering. Okay. If you're going to register an activity on the other parent's time and it's going to impact their time with the child, they need to be aware of that and willing to participate. Otherwise, the child only goes to 50% of the events.
Mm-hmm.
And so the importance of being on the same page with supporting activities and making sure everybody's involved, it does come down to finances sometimes, because they're now living in a single parent household where the finances are lower, but also if there's a lot of travel, with certain activities, they can't go out of state every weekend and get hotel rooms. And and so some of those get to be difficult. Also with extracurricular activities that I see a lot are relocation or families that live a distance apart and whether they're able to get to those practices or over the summer months if they're able to go to the camps that they want to. And trying to coordinate how that happens without it harming the child's interests. I mean, there's been times where children have said, I'm going to give up my activities because it's too big of a fight for mom and dad. And so activities seem to be a big area. Outside of what you've mentioned, I would say religious disputes sometimes comes up. And even if the order is very, very clear, you may have a birthday that falls on a holiday or a funeral or a wedding or a vacation, and trying to figure out what trumps what and whether enough advance notice took place, and try to differentiate how those things are going to go. Our goal really is to minimize the amount of conflict and to be proactive and solution focused.
Sure. You mentioned financials, Emily, and I think that, and I don't remember specifically in our parent coordinator statute, I know Minnesota is very specific saying that financials are not something that a parent coordinator is going to address. As a general rule, I try to avoid that because most of it's decided with child support and in that lane. So a lot of times I'll avoid that. Once in a while, I'll say, if you both agree and it's within the order or vaguely within the order, if you both agree and want me to make this decision, we can take a look at it. But financials are something that more than not, I try to avoid.
Sure. So there are some areas that might end up being a little bit off limits then.
Yes.
And it depends on the family or the parents.
Okay. Certainly.
Yes. And that is, that's also my philosophy, is if it's already defined in the court order, we essentially want to uphold and reaffirm the court order. Also, when it comes to us making a decision, the court order takes precedence over anything else. Their specific court order takes precedence. So if I need to make a decision, I'm going to base it on their court order and then base it on the South Dakota Parenting Guidelines as number two, and then what their input is or what they've done in the past or maybe how other states do it as the third, if there's kind of a level of hierarchy there. The South Dakota statutes, it's statute 25-4-70, that actually very clearly defines the duties of a parent coordinator.
Okay.
So it specifically says what we can do as far as assisting with co-parenting. It's not just facilitating agreements, and it's not just making decisions. It's really trying to help them co-parent, find ways we can recommend therapy, we can recommend what we think they should go through if it's co-parenting classes. It's really, it even says to exclude attorneys as much as possible. We're really there to just work with the parties on trying to help them. A lot of times through our family wizard or email, I tend to monitor a lot of communication. You do as well. We monitor, we interject when we see that it's inappropriate. We can guide them on ways of improving communication and conflict resolution.
Sure. Can you explain a little bit about what our family wizard is? Because I think there are some people who would not know what that is who are listening.
Our family wizard started in about 2003 up in Minneapolis, and I've seen it get better and better each year. They do amazing trainings. They're very invested in helping parents that live in two separate homes have more of a business-like approach of raising their child. So it's a really neat system that I've seen the quirks kind of get worked out over time, where it has a message function, it has a calendar function where they can each put in proposals for exchange days or all activities, doctor's appointments, and then there's an info bank where they can put in insurance information, medical information, babysitter information. There's also now OFW Pay where they can reimburse each other through the system for activities, a journal or a moment section where they can put uploads of maybe artwork or paperwork and things that they can put in there. So it's a very focused platform for parents to communicate. A really neat portion of it is that you can see when the other parent logged in last. You can see when they've read your message or if they have not read it. And so that's really nice if people are ignoring you or if they just really haven't seen it. And so it has, it's documentation focused as well to be able to print it. It does have the ability to add professionals for free. It's a paid service,
it's paid
a little
service
over $100 a year.
Families. Okay.
Yeah, but you can have professionals that can oversee. That's a free thing. And then you can also add a child to log in to be able to see the calendar, which I think is important for the child to see what's going on in their life. Because it's It's not really mom's or dad's calendar. It's the child's.
It's theirs. Okay.
I would say I don't use it a ton. I would say it's a great service for certain cases.
Yeah.
Very high conflict cases where we know professionals are going to need to be monitoring. Mm-hmm. Maybe a case like Shanna mentioned where one party has a history of not responding or saying they responded. So again, it shows that timestamp of login so that you can track that. Whatever the system, whether it's our family wizard or through email, a lot of times, especially in a custody evaluation when I'm making recommendations and then as a parent coordinator, I'll say text messaging is clearly not working.
Yeah.
We can't read the mood. We can't. Mm-hmm. It's so fast that nobody takes that pause before they hit send. So whether, like I said, whether it's our family wizard or email or a different platform, being able to slow that down and have something that's more formal, I guess, is usually a recommendation that I would make.
Okay. So it might not be for all families, but it's a good fit when those situations have happened.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd say I typically recommend like a and B forms of communication. So A might be our family wizard, do that first, or email. And then if it's a secondary form, if it needs to be a response immediately, then to utilize text or then to utilize phone. But sure. If you have individuals that can't mm-hmm. speak on the phone, that are very impulsive with text messages mm-hmm. or that send a multitude of messages a day where it overwhelms the other mm-hmm. person, you really have to think about what method is appropriate. And like we said, every case is so different. Sometimes we really have to be creative in this role on what's going to work for this family. A benefit that I see when parents are getting overwhelmed with a lot of communication is that our family wizard will send you a message via email or via text, and it will say, there's a message there for you.
Okay.
But I always recommend parents wait till your kids are in bed mm-hmm. until you're in the right mindset to sit down and mm-hmm. read it and respond rather than reacting. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is probably one of the biggest challenges with parent coordination, I think, is that I kind of describe it as the over-communicator or the reactive and then the more withdrawn yep. or the one who avoids. And it seems like they're often in these conflicts together. Mm-hmm. So it's slowing one down and kind of speeding the other yeah. one up to somewhere meet in some sort of middle road.
As I listen to you guys talk to, I'm kind of hearing this trend of every case is going to be different. So there might be, I've heard people say, like, it doesn't seem to make sense. Like, there's these two different, I can hear two different stories and two completely different situations with different rulings that are being provided. And maybe that makes sense. Like, you guys are looking at what does the court order say first in South Dakota Parenting Guidelines, which South Dakota Parenting Guidelines is consistent, assuming kids are of the same age. But then you guys weigh in based on that. So it's not like Shanna decides, I don't like this person, I can just make whatever decision I want. Like, there's rules for you and what you need to be looking at first. And so that might change your decisions and your role from clients to clients.
Definitely. I would say that my broken record statement in parent coordination cases is it's not within the court order. I mean, people are constantly asking for changes that are outside of the order. Yeah, maybe it doesn't make sense because sometimes court orders don't make sense, mm-hmm. but that's what we have to work off of. And I can't go beyond that. So if you want to change that, then we have to look at a different route. But we can only work within the court order. And then really the kids are our bosses in these cases. We're working for their best interest. Do we talk to them in every case? No. At least I don't, but it's their interest. So one parent A may have one opinion, parent B may have another. If that's not in the best interest of the kids, then it's not going to work. We have to look for C.
Sure. How do you determine what is best interest of the kids, especially if you don't get to meet them? Are there other people that you talk to, or how do you gather that information?
Yeah, I'm in the same position as her. Is I actually try not to over-involve myself with the children because I would have such infrequent contact with them that I wouldn't expect to build a good rapport, you know, or I don't want them to have to meet another professional if they already have a therapist or if they have other people that they've met. So as a parent coordinator, we would reach out to the school or the therapist or whoever it is that we could gather that information from in order to get that if we need to make a decision regarding what's best. I try to make it a very solid decision because we may have to go to court to defend it. And so it can't just be based on whether we like a parent. I mean, right. I always tell parents, like, it doesn't matter if I like you or not. I mean, I'm the one that has to testify to support this, and it has to be in the best interest of your child. And so we really look at all aspects of the child and the situation.
I would say the majority of the cases that get to PC level, the kids are already in some level of therapy.
Sure.
And if they're not, that's a pretty quick recommendation that I will make. Okay. And then making sure it's a therapist that's willing to talk with me and consult and then, you know, base things off of that.
That makes sense. Okay.
I feel like a big part of our job is providing referrals and resources. So it's important for us to know what is available in the community and to help, whether it's people, whether it's books, whether it's services that are out there for families to gain that information, because the families we work with absolutely love their children. Mm-hmm. They're just going through a very difficult time, whether it's the emotions from the residual effects of the divorce, whether they don't like each other, or, you know, they're just going through the grief and loss of healing and starting mm-hmm. new. And so they love their children. Sometimes they just don't understand the impact of their behaviors on mm-hmm. the kids, mm-hmm. or they're too wrapped up in their own emotions mm-hmm. that they're not seeing it from the kid's perspective.
Sure.
And so we just try to educate on that as well.
And I imagine that you guys have worked in cases where maybe one parent thinks that the other parent is doing something really damaging to the child, is causing them harm, trying to destroy their relationship. Is that something that you guys have experienced in your work?
Yes.
But I can see by your faces that the answer is yes. So to assume that sometimes parents are coming in with this anxiety of, I don't want to give this power to this parent coordinator. If I think my, you know, ex-partner is dangerous, that there's going to be some hesitancy on there and to agree to that. What do you guys talk about with them to help them to feel comfortable with this process?
Again, I would go back to the court order and say, if the judge, or maybe you've even agreed to this, or if a judge has made a ruling that this parent is to have this time without an active CPS investigation or something major that's happened, we have to uphold the court order in that person's visitation. So okay. It may be managing your own stress and anxiety, getting your own therapist, doing your own work to manage while it's going on and supporting your child without putting your fears onto the child. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is coaching the other parent and getting them some skills, because that certainly happens. But if that order is that they're getting certain set parenting time, then that's what's going to happen.
Right. So that's not you being a cold, unfeeling person. That's you recognizing the limitations of what the statute says you're allowed to do as a parenting coordinator.
Right. And we can't go off of your opinion and your allegations mm-hmm. because that's, I mean, the order is what the order is. And in most of these cases, it's been litigated. They've been in front of a judge. They've mm-hmm. had their time to make their case. And the judge, this is what the judge is going with. Mm-hmm.
And we tell them that, you know, I think it's hard, because some people don't know what the process is, or maybe even their attorney didn't tell them what the limitations are. Mm-hmm. And so they may come in with an abundance of information trying to change custody. And it's for us to say, this isn't the realm to do that. I want to hear your concerns. But if it's things that have already been presented or from 10 years ago, let's look at today and go forward. You know, how does that help us with where we're at now? It may come off cold sometimes to people, but sure. it's, you know, it opens up a can of worms from the past that isn't necessary, because mm-hmm. this is where we're at. We can't change that. And I've told people, if you do think that there's safety issues, call Child Protection or tell me those. You know, sure. we are mandated reporters. If there mm-hmm. are major safety issues, or if you do want to change a custody, to go through the court system and get a custody evaluation or file okay. a motion for a change of custody. Mm-hmm. But this isn't the realm to do it. And I think that's sometimes hard for people. They can sure propose a change in the schedule. Just yesterday, you know, we had people, they agreed to 50-50, but one party wanted to modify the schedule. It's okay. We can talk about it. You guys can agree to anything outside of the court order, but I can't change it.
Okay.
But if they want to agree, as long as it remains 50-50 and they want to try a different schedule, that's okay. We can talk about that. And, you know, or sometimes the court order, if a child's 2 when they divorce and now the child's 14, mm-hmm. things maybe are different. Mm-hmm. And so the court order might not be as applicable.
Sure.
And so they can make those agreements, and we can memorialize those agreements, that if they want to modify things, that's okay. And so it is working through some of those changes too, where introduction of new significant others, or the kids are now driving, or, mm-hmm. you know, just different issues that come up, just developmental differences with the kids as they grow. So mm-hmm. there's things that when people go through a divorce that they don't think about is going to come up 10 years down the
road. Of course. Absolutely. Okay. So there were 2 questions that I had from that. One, just making sure I clarify this. So if a parent says, you know, I'd really like to start the conversation of transitioning from our current custody agreement to 50-50, that is not a parent coordinator's role. I mean, they can if both agree to it, they can you said memorialize that. That's my second question. Does that mean just like put it in writing?
Yes, we can definitely talk about any proposals they have. If they say, you know, this current schedule isn't working, good, bad, or otherwise, I've seen parents step down and say, you know, I think they need to be at one house more than the other, you know, and really put their kid first. I mean, okay. I've seen, or they say, you know what, yeah, let's move towards 50-50. They can do trial periods, and it's kind of a nice area to say, you know, we've been doing a 2-2-3. Let's try a 50. Let's try every other week. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But,
sure.
You know, it's a good environment to explore what would work best. Or say if a child has activities on every Thursday night, maybe you need to change the overnight to a Tuesday night instead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as long as they agree.
They both agree.
They have power over the court order if they both agree.
Okay.
I would say that those are probably the minority in the cases that we see, that people are functioning that well together.
Sure, sure.
That's perfect world. Like when I went into this job, I'm like, oh, this would be so great. We can come up with agreements and avoid the legal system. Nah, it doesn't really happen all that often. It makes us happy in this role when it does. But more often than not, it's one side saying this isn't working and continually kind of trying to force the change. Okay. And sometimes it comes to the point where I say, this is not PC anymore. This is you trying to modify, or you trying to do this. You're going to have to step out of PC and go back to court
to
do that.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So if one parent says, I really want 50-50, and the other says, no way, I'm not on board. It is a court situation. It's a custody eval or something like that.
Yeah.
In order to make that formal change within the court order.
If one party is opposed to it, then we really can't discuss. You know, I mean, there's no purpose in going through that in our role.
Sure.
No, it's not our role to encourage one party to give in or to bend to that. The other thing I wanted to mention, going back to if one party has fears or concerns, that's a great motivator to get that child into therapy if they're not already.
Yeah.
You know, if you have this series of concerns about what's happening at the other home, then let's get a professional involved to represent the child's interests even more.
And, you know, just from my perspective as a therapist, something that I think parents come in with confusion on, especially if they have been referred by either one of you or somebody else who does a similar role, is they're like, oh, okay, Emily will make that decision. And so it's always really important for parents to understand that I'm here to help you to understand your child and to help you to like help them as they transition between households and things like that. But I also won't be that person that's be able to make that decision and say, yes, this person's unsafe or this person's not, you know, fit to be a parent like the other parent might think. So I know it's a confusing piece for people.
It is. I think, again, going back outside of South Dakota, some states are so specific and careful about what therapists can do and have that, whether it through the licensing board or state statute. South Dakota is a little less formal, I think, in that. For the most part, therapists, again, stay in their lane, but every once in a while you'll have one who does kind of make recommendations or represent things, and we have to go back and say, that's not really their role.
Sure.
In reminding people that education piece again, because this is totally new and foreign to most people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of providing education by us and by therapists and whoever's involved.
And it's the best for everyone, because we want the therapist to be there for the child and to not take sides with the parents.
Right.
You know, we want them to be that very neutral, safe spot for the kids. And so when I do request records or to contact a therapist, you know, the notes are great, but I never expect to get that, even a treatment summary or just a phone consultation, because I actually have like a safe harbor part of my contract that says if I talk to the child's therapist, I don't have to tell the parents everything, because I want to protect that relationship with the child and the therapist, because that's important and they need that safe spot because they're going through a lot with the parental conflict. Because, our main goal, I mean, research shows the longer duration, high conflict families are, that's what has the biggest impact on the kids.
It's absolutely.
Not the divorce. It's not the schedule. It's not the age of the kids. It is the parental ability to communicate and cooperate. So their co-parenting relationship is very important.
It's super important. Yes, absolutely.
I think even going off that with therapy for themselves, I often say, I don't look at that as a negative. I look at that as a positive when you're seeing somebody. And I also rarely, there's a few agencies in the area that only will give records. But for the most part, I say, I'm not going to request records. I want a conversation with your therapist with the basics.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel like every word you say is going to be communicated to me. it's more for you to get skills or you to get the support that you need. And the same for the kids. I never want to put therapists in a bad spot. I want to keep that relationship open and neutral as possible because that's not the purpose of it.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much. You know, that's a hard part, especially when it comes to the kids. The kids have this fear of, well, who are you going to tell if I ask them a question about how they feel about something? Because I usually try to include them as much as I can to say, hey, there are people who are helping your parents to make some decisions and they want to know what your opinion is. Let's talk about it a little bit. Their first thing is like, I don't want you to tell them everything that I've said. You know, what have you already told them? Like, they get scared. And that just ruins the therapeutic relationship if they think that everything that they're sharing going forward is going to be shared with their parents. That's a big thing, is making sure their parents don't hear what they have to say. So I appreciate that you both have those policies within your practices to make sure that you're using the information to make the right suggestions or recommendations, but not just relaying it all back and forth.
And I'm very clear when I talk with kids. It's different depending on their age, obviously. It's not, you can't do this with a 2 or 3 year old. Yeah. But the older kids, and most of them, whether it's PC or custody evaluation, most of them, like I said, have already been in therapy. So I'll say, you know, this is different than therapy. What you tell me does have to go into my report, will be seen by mom and dad. So if there's things you don't want or you don't feel comfortable. So I really try to distinguish that for them and say, you know, this is not your job to make decisions or tell anybody what you want. I just want to hear kind of what you like about each house or what works and what doesn't work. So really trying to keep them too out of that decision-making role or put any more pressure on kids than they already have in these situations.
Sure.
Absolutely. I would say that's one of my biggest things in this work, is that I feel kids are given too much power, or parents are relying too much on what their kids think, which I want to know where the kids are coming from, and I absolutely want to know what they think and why they think that, but I don't want them to feel like they have to make the decision or that they get to make the decision because they don't know all aspects of the situation, just brain development wise. You know, even if they're a teenager or different ages or stages of development, they're not fully capable of making that decision, and they don't understand how it's going to impact their relationships long term. Mm-hmm. And so some kids have absolutely wonderful reasons why they want what they want, and they're willing to express themselves well, and that could be even little kids. And some kids don't. Some kids just, you know, are manipulated by one parent, or say, well, this parent's going to buy me a car, or this parent, you know, and so getting to the underlying reason is important. But I also view it as the child is like that giant piece of the puzzle, but there's a lot of other puzzle pieces. And so I absolutely want to know what they think. My philosophy is voice, but not choice, because I don't want them to feel like they have to or that they get to.
It's a heavy weight.
It is, and even if they think that I want to make this decision, I always say, when your kid's 40, they might look back and say, wow, why did I make that decision? So I don't think it's fair to put that on them.
I would agree. And, you know, something you guys mentioned earlier is there's this emotion. You mentioned, Erin, that, like, you and your husband might disagree on decisions, and it's the same for me. I mean, I usually try to share that example with my clients, too, is parents do not always get along and agree about what to do, so they have to figure out how to make that decision. So when you're separated, there's high emotions involved. So a kid might come home from school and say, you know, Johnny was mean to me. And they'll be like, well, what happened? They'll talk through it. Like, what do you want to do? And then if they come home and say, Dad was mean to me, well, Dad's not supposed to be mean to you. And like, there's this emotional piece of what happened historically between them and that relationship that leads to them giving that more of that power to their child to make those decisions. And so I do appreciate that you kind of give that reminder that kids should have that voice, but the adults are the ones who have to make those decisions and carry that heavy weight. For me, it's hard when I get asked by an attorney, or if I've had to testify for a judge or anything like that. Like, that's a really heavy emotional weight to carry. And I have a lot of education. I have a lot of experience. So if I think about a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old being asked a similar question, that's so much for them. So it's really awesome that you have those policies in place.
These are two parents that they absolutely love. It's part of them. And they want, kids just are generally, they want to please their parents. They don't want to upset them. And every kid is at different stages. I think the hardest age that I deal with is like the 7 to 12 year olds, because they stuff a lot of the feelings. They don't want to cause waves. They don't want, they're not outspoken. they're incredibly intelligent, but they don't feel like their voice matters because they're not yet teenagers, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that their way of handling things, it's really tough. And I think therapy is absolutely a benefit, whether it's for parents or kids. I know there's still that stigma out there that it's going to be used against them or that it's a bad thing, but it's not. I mean, it's normal to have adjustment-related issues mm-hmm. for kids, or right. it's normal for parents to struggle after a divorce because mm-hmm. it's a huge transition.
It's just part of that process.
Yeah, and I think honesty and being willing to address that with the parents and, you know, that for them to just kind of have that insight with, you know, I need better direction, I'm letting my emotions take over, or, you know, just to seek out additional help, I see as a huge positive for parents instead of a negative.
Absolutely. So getting into more of the logistics of the parent coordination, you said earlier like there's a retainer. So is it independent? Like each of you have your own prices, or is this something that like the state says that this is what the cost is for everybody who wants to engage in this?
I believe we each have our own agreements and set prices, and we'll consult, especially Shanna and I, but, you know, we'll check in with other people and kind sure. of see what everybody's doing, or go to conferences and talk to people or listen to people from other states who, some states have very specific detailed processes, some states have nothing. So, I mean, learning from other people and then figuring that out, but always being clear, mm-hmm. you know, upfront in that agreement.
Sure.
The court order defines how the fee is split, whether one parent okay. needs to pay or whether it's 50-50 or 60-40. And then when they come to us with the court order, we draft our agreement, we send that out to initiate the case, we have them pay that retainer so it's there when they need it, so they don't have to come up with that money down the road whenever if there's an okay. issue. The contracts, I think that all of us have, are quite clear because it is such a confusing role. Especially if the court order, sometimes the court order just says this person's appointed as parent coordinator and the parents don't even know what that really means.
What that means, okay.
And so we really try to make them know, because even if they have an attorney that doesn't practice family law, the attorney might not know what parent coordination right. is. Like I said, it was just 2013 when it made it into the statutes. Mm-hmm. It's been used prior to that, but there's still kind of an idea where some people don't know what it is, or therapists don't know what it is, or it's not therapy. We do have to make decisions. You know, we have to provide direction. It's not confidential. That's mm-hmm. a big piece of parent coordination, is that we can testify. Everything they tell us is in our file. We're okay. appointed by the court. So it's not a confidential process in that regard. And we can report back to the court with whether they're participating or not, or how they're acting, I guess. If it comes up to trial or a home study or something, we can report back. The one thing I wanted to differentiate is mediation.
Yeah.
I've even had attorneys call it mediation, and they've even put it in an order as mediation, but they actually want parent coordination. And I said, those are very, very different. In South Dakota statute, they're defined very, very different. So mediation is, they don't put a retainer down, they just pay as they go, okay. at least for mine. And there's several people, the state website has a whole list of approved mediators and parent coordinators. But mediation is confidential, which means if they ever go to court, I cannot testify. The only thing that's admissible, it's similar to a settlement negotiations between attorneys, where it's not admissible if you go to trial. So the only thing that is admissible is the memo, if yes, they met and they did reach an agreement,
sure.
or yes, they met and they did not reach an agreement. There's been times that I've had to testify and all I can say is, yes, they met. Yes, this is their agreement.
Okay.
But I can't say anything about what was talked about.
Discussed. Okay.
So mediation is different in that regard.
I appreciate you clarifying that, because that is an unknown thing, I would imagine, for most people.
It may just seem really minor to them or the attorneys in the language, but if it does go to court, that's a very big difference.
Well, I think people think about mediation being like, we're just going to help facilitate this conversation, and it might even be used in the right, like, legal sense.
Yes. And in mediation, we can't make decisions. We can say, this is what other families mm-hmm. have done. We can try and brainstorm. And yeah, we really do try to help them resolve it. But there's that limitation of, well, you guys can't agree, you're going to have to go to court. With parent coordination, we do have more ability to make recommendations or decisions. And, you know, when it does go to court, if they do have 14 days, if we make a formal recommendation or decision, they have 14 days to file a motion to ask the court to overturn it if they think that we're wrong.
Okay.
Which is okay. You know, mm-hmm. that's, we all need some oversight. And so if it goes to court, we testify and we explain the reasoning for our decision.
So that's the only way that it can be, like, not comply, the order or the recommendation that you made, that the only way to not comply with that is to file a stipulation and go back to court and let the judge hear why you made your decision. Then the judge rules on if your decision is going to be upheld or a different one.
Correct.
Okay.
I think one of the biggest frustrations I have with the PC process, and that certain clients will have as well, is it's hard to have those consequences. You know, Shannon and I have talked about this over the years, and other professionals too. Like, if somebody isn't following a directive or a recommendation, what do we do with that other than reporting it back to the court? It's not like we can put them in jail. You know, like, it's not, we don't have the authority to
find them in contempt.
Yeah. You know, our options are limited. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's financial, but that only goes so far too. And there's nothing that's going to force them to, you know, that's kind of one of the frustrations with the system, I guess, is sometimes I'll hear from somebody, okay, well, she's not doing this. What are you going to do about it? And I'm like, ugh, I don't know. You know, thinking in my head, like, what do I have to use? So that can get frustrating. It doesn't come up a ton, I don't think. Usually we can work through it and people respect the directive or the order, or like Shannon explained, the process of going back to court. But every once in a while, that can be a drawback.
Just like kind of other services too, sometimes what one person do or with control is just quit paying. So then they think that you'll quit working. But if there's a decision that needs to be made and they say, well, I'm just not going to pay, so then you can't make the decision. In my contract, it says the other party can pay that money and still participate, and I can still continue. Okay. And I've scheduled appointments, and I've said both of you need to come. And if one chooses not to come and chooses not to provide their input, I can still make the decision. So just by them saying, I'm not coming, I'm not going to participate, that doesn't stop the process. And I think that can be frustrating. They use that as a form of control sometimes.
Sure.
And if there's a decision that needs to be made, we can't just stop for that.
Right.
But I think it can be very costly. That's a downfall. And I know we're both very sensitive with that. I don't want to nickel and dime people. I don't want them contacting me 100 times a day. I want them to be able to only reach out when they need us.
Yeah.
And so money is a good motivator for most people too, that you don't want to have to pay us to listen to these. Like, please reach out when you need us, and then we'll schedule a session. Yeah, my philosophy is just keep us in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Use me if when you need me. Maybe wait until you have a couple agenda items to discuss, and then order of importance, we'll talk about those when you come in. I just tell people to bring an agenda with proposals in each area, so we're focused on solutions instead of focused on the problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be really frustrating for people, because sometimes it does open a can of worms that doesn't even need to be. Like a gal yesterday said, are we trying to find a solution to a problem that doesn't even exist?
Sure.
And I thought that really hit home. Like, sometimes people just bring things up to vent, but what are we supposed to do about it?
Yeah.
You know,
what is retaliation, the solution? I think. You know, somebody brings something up. Well, I'm going
to,
now that you're bringing this up.
I have to go
up
with something.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think two things about the fees. Yes, it can be expensive, but it's a lot cheaper than being in the court system, paying attorney, paying for trials, certainly. And then also every once in a while people will ask if their insurance will cover it, and that does not, because it's not a therapeutic service.
Yep.
So wanted to be clear on that.
Yeah, that can be confusing for people for sure. And Shannon, you mentioned that there might be an order that says the court appoints this parent coordinator. Is that how it typically goes, or do parents also have a choice to say, once it's stipulated, we're going to choose who we want?
Yes, the parents usually can tell their attorneys if they agree upon a certain person, maybe because of fees or the background or whatever it is, maybe their availability or just if they're more comfortable. I always encourage people to call around, see personalities, who they're comfortable with. Some people want a male, some people want a female, some people want somebody with a legal background. There's people with legal backgrounds, there's people with therapy backgrounds, you know, so finding which person that they feel comfortable working with. And typically it'll say if the parties cannot agree, then they shall submit a few names to the judge and the judge will decide.
Okay.
And most people who do a lot of family law attorneys know us and know what everybody has to offer. The main problem is there's not enough of us to go around, and we can only take so many of these cases. Like I explained before, the time commitment is tough, especially with the unknown. So there comes times when all of us are full or can't take any more. So that's the challenge, is that there's just not enough of us to go around, I would say.
Sure.
I would say in the entire state, there's less than 15 of us. and we try to consult. I try to consult and get resources from others across the state, and we definitely are not competitive with each other. We want to learn from each other. Mm-hmm. But also, I think in bigger cities, if there's a case where one parent says something that hurts your feelings, people just jump off the case right away because there's other parent coordinators. It's hard. It's hard work, and people don't like us a lot,
mm-hmm.
but we're here for the kids, and we know that that's what we're in for, and we do try to tough it out as much as we can. We can't just jump ship because we know that there may not be somebody else that's willing to take the case because of the caseload. So I do think that all of us parent coordinators that I've met that talk to really work hard and want the best. It's not an easy type of work. So I think that people are in it are really invested in helping families and helping kids.
So if there is somebody who's listening right now who says, I think that this sounds like a great idea, I would like to become one of these professionals, what do they do? What is the training that's required for this?
Absolutely. On the state website, through the South Dakota Codified Laws, there is an application that's out there. It is under Chapter 25-4. There's several of them in like 60 to 70, but the actual application is out there, and you have to apply. The minimum is having a master's degree, having specified experience in mediation background, having some family law knowledge, and then shadowing, I believe, is what it says. But there's trainings, there's specific trainings. The Association of Family and Conciliation Courts is an amazing organization that both of us are part of. They do training for parent coordinators. They have an immense amount of worldwide case studies and, you know, just the family law journal and all of this that's focused on parent coordination and custody work and just a wealth of knowledge out there. But they do a training. I got my training at Hamline University up in Minneapolis.
I can't remember. It's been so long. Minnesota has a lot of resources, mm-hmm. so it's nice having Minnesota, but AFCC, both for professional training, but I also often refer families to their website because they have great parent resources and tons of information. I think it's afccnet.org, if I remember right. So that's a great resource for people. I also tell people who are interested, whether it's attorneys or therapists or whatever profession, reach out to one of us. We all want to share these cases. So reach out to us. It takes a unique personality, I think, and experiences to do this work. But like Shanna said, we're not competitive. We want to bring people into the field. It is such a valuable service. And I really think the more people we can get into it, the more families that we can help. And we have great attorneys these days who are open to the process and mm-hmm. understand its place in the field. So
I feel like the judges are also understanding it more than historically. You know, in the past, maybe a pastor or a therapist or somebody would say, well, I'll do parent coordination, but they really don't know what it was. So the statutes and just having more clarity on what it really is and what the limitations are. But yes, I have people shadow quite a bit. Anybody that's interested, I am very open to law students, third-year law students have to shadow for mediation, you know, and I'm completely open to people shadowing or teaching them about the process, because I think that if people are interested in it, I would say some of the best skills to have are to have an understanding of mental health and child development and family law, but also to be assertive, to really be focused on what's best, not to be easily manipulated, and, you know, just to really be focused in on solutions and helping the family as much as you can. And I think optimism is really important. Mm-hmm. I think if we don't believe in them, they're not going to believe in themselves.
Of course.
And so I think we have to be optimistic that things can improve, because sometimes nobody is optimistic. You know, sometimes they don't have anybody in their corner to say, we can make this better.
Absolutely. So if anybody is interested in getting in contact with a parent coordinator, you did say that the state has a listing of that. And I can put a link to that in our show notes below this when we put it on the website. In terms of reaching out to you, do they just like send an email? Do they call? How do they get started with the process? And is it like, or is it the attorney has to give them the order? They have to have their order in place or stipulation in place before they reach out to you? How does that work?
Yeah, as Shanna said earlier, we want a court order, because then it gives us the guidelines, kind of how what I was talking about before is the backing to enforce our directives and recommendations. So the majority of cases, I've taken a couple where the people come to me together and say, we really want to do this, and they're both in agreement, and they're really close together. Like I said, kind of those perfect world cases, but they're few and far between. So most of these people would be involved in the legal process and have an attorney involved, so we would want it included in the order. Often, not often, but every once in a while, I will have attorneys or a judge sign off on an order putting me as the PC in a case, and then I don't hear from them because we don't know if we don't receive it or if they don't reach out. And then they'll contact me with their first emergency, and I'll say, no, we can't jump in at an emergency. We have to have that initial meeting. We need to do things in order. I can't make an on-the-spot decision when I know nothing. And it's always one person reaching out to where the other one's avoiding. So I said, you have to. And so I try to educate attorneys. You know, if you get an order with me on the case or anybody on a case, you need to let us know, and you need to tell the people to reach out and get that first appointment set up, because we have to have, we don't, at least I don't do a ton of background information. I don't need to hear about every conflict they've ever had. But we do need to have those goals, and we need to have that court order and know what direction we're going.
I would say, too, some frustrations of some parent coordinators is that they just get appointed without getting asked first. I very rarely get asked first. I usually just get an order sent to me, and either email or mail, and I just say, please give me the contact information of the parties, and then I mail out an intro packet. They may not respond for 6 months, which I'm okay with if they don't have, if they feel like they need to come up with the funds and, you know, that it's not an emergency on their end. As long as we get a background session scheduled at some point, that's okay. If it's overwhelming for them, they don't have to do it like immediately. But to get a case open so I know that I'm here if you need me. But I would like to have that. Some, it's been like 3 or 4 years later. Yeah. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, you're listed in our court order. Okay. Well, I have nothing, guys. Mm-hmm. So I need to have some of that information. But some parent coordinators would like to be asked first if they can take it. The problem being that if the parties pay their attorneys to get this order and it says a specific parent coordinator, and then if that parent coordinator can't take it, then what? Mm-hmm. Then do they have to get a new order? Or, you know, then we feel, you know, like we're stuck. And so
yeah.
I own resolutions, counseling, and mediation. And so Rachel Kukta is also there, and she does it. So sometimes it'll say just resolutions, a provider at resolutions, which that's okay. Just me or Aaron, mm-hmm. or I mean me or Rachel. So then either one of us can.
Sure.
But at your office, I'm guessing, are you the only one that does parent coordination?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, or sometimes it'll list a couple of us. Recently there was one, I think it said that if Aaron cannot, then Shanna should. It's nice if they check, at least get some background on who the person is to make sure they're available and to understand the fees, because some fees can be vastly different. Mm-hmm. You know, there are providers maybe in Northern Iowa or Minnesota, and some of the fees are very different depending mm-hmm. on the person, too.
Sure. Well, I don't know that the answer to this is going to be clear, because I'm sure there'll be something that you will think about later. But is there anything else that you were really hoping to share with the community about parent coordination that we did not tackle today?
Lately, I've been trying to tell people I don't want them to see it as an extension of the court battle. I want them to see it not as a scary process, but as more of a weaning out of that court process and starting fresh. And, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, here's another court-appointed person, and they just kind of assume that you're part of the judge or the attorney kind of philosophy. And I want them to know that our goal really is to help them. It's not to stir up conflict. We really want to find solutions so they can move forward without having to rely on us or attorneys or the court. Mm-hmm. And to not view it as a scary or intimidating process.
Sure.
Yeah, I look at it more as a problem-solving process. And like you said, the moving on and creating a new relationship, a co-parenting relationship, to you're going to be together forever as long as your children are alive or you're alive. Mm-hmm. So you need to figure these things out and be able to adapt. I don't want to work with you forever. Mm-hmm. I want you to learn and grow and be able to do this. Because your kids want you to do this. That's what right. I hear from kids more than anything is, we want them to stop fighting. We want them to get along. Mm-hmm. Can you please help with that? Mm-hmm. I will try.
I will do my best.
Yeah.
So it is your job to work yourself out of a job, basically. That's a success for you, is if you can say, you guys know how to do this without high conflict, go forth and do this on your own.
For sure. The longer we can stay out of court and the less issues, the better.
Mm-hmm. I try to celebrate the small achievements. You know, if we can teach them to be parents, they are the ones that should be making the decisions. It shouldn't be us or the judge or the attorneys. They are the parents for this child, and not just till they're 18 for the rest of their lives. Okay. They have to go to the wedding together. They have to raise grandkids together. Yeah. And just that reality of how important, I think, generationally, co-parenting has become so increasingly important. Mm-hmm. And both parents are often very involved. And hands down, these parents love their children. They just need to learn the right way of protecting their children of what's going on and moving forward. Mm-hmm. So their child can be a happy little successful person.
Absolutely. Well, I started out this conversation today saying that we were going to be talking about both parent coordination and custody evaluations. Based on the time that we've talked today, we're going to do two parts of our podcast here. So we're going to end this one, and then we'll do a part two with Shanna and Aaron talking about custody evaluations. You said your name of your practice, Shanna, but go ahead and give people the contact information for how they can reach out to you.
Yeah, it's based out of Sioux Falls. It's Resolutions Counseling and Mediation. However, I do work all across the state. All of us parent coordinators do work all across the state, just so you know, with Zoom and telephone. And mm-hmm. we want to help the small parts of South Dakota that can't get the help, you know, that don't have providers. And so all of us are really willing to help reach out as much as we can. So my website's sdresolutions.com, and my contact information is there. They can email. Email is probably the best way to get a hold of me. Sure. That's shanna@sdresolutions.com.
Perfect. And Aaron, how about you?
I'm in private practice with a group called Integrative Wellness here in Sioux Falls. And also, like Shanna said, we one good thing about COVID, I say, is that it helped us learn these services of doing things through video and virtual. So yeah, we do. And really, we didn't really touch on this too much, but very rarely in a case do we meet person to person, usually in the beginning. Sometimes they'll say, if we cannot make a resolution through various emails, then we have to sit down. But a lot of it is through email, phone calls, video. So people don't have to be here to do it. But anyways, Integrative Wellness is my office. You can look it up on the website. And like Shanna said, email is usually the easiest too. I try to model for my clients and set very firm limits on communication, not during the weekend, not at night. I think one thing that we need to help people with is to know that not everything, most things don't need an immediate response. Mm-hmm. I think that's one problem with our younger generations as well. I know I teach my kids, nope, they're not going to respond immediately. That's
okay.
That's okay. That's good. So work on that as well. But yeah, email and just reach out if you have questions either for yourself or if it's something that you're interested in getting involved in as a professional as well.
Perfect. Well, I want to thank you too for this conversation, because even though I was aware of what parent coordination was, there was a lot that I did not know about. So as a therapist who had some information, I got more. And so I imagine that parents who are listening today are learning a lot of information. So thank you so much for being here. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us today for our conversation on parent coordination. If you enjoyed our discussion today or have a follow-up question, please feel free to leave a comment below. Do remember, though, that the comment section is a public setting. So if your comment is a question about your desire to get yourself set up with therapy for your child, or more, you know, more questions specific to your particular situation, either contact Shanna or Aaron if you have those questions for them, or contact our office at 605-275-0009, extension 1, or info@SiouxFallsCounseling.com, and you can talk with our administrative team. Thank you so much for listening today.
Thank you for listening to the Knowledgeable Parent Podcast. Did you like what you heard? Share your opinion by rating the podcast on your favorite platform. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.